The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I think we all know how popular histories of World War II are, from best-selling books, movies like, I don't know, old-time movies like The Longest Day or Sands of Iwo Jima, Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List, miniseries like Band of Brothers in the Pacific. So, and of course, I think you're practically guaranteed an Oscar nomination if you make a movie about the Holocaust. And I, probably like many of you, I was fascinated by World War II as a kid, and I couldn't get enough of it. I read all these biographies of Hitler and battle stories and things like this, and the Holocaust, of course. And I think one of the reasons for this fascination has not only to do with the scope of the war, which encompassed all the great powers, six continents, 50 million dead, but because it seemingly paints such a sharp picture of good versus evil. On the one side are the brutal, genocidal Nazis, really the incarnation of evil, who, along with their allies, the Japanese Empire, are pitted against Britain and the United States, the paragons of democracy and freedom. Usually, in these accounts, the Soviet Union is not mentioned or kind of ignored. But this sentiment's, I think, reflected not just in mainstream media, but also among liberals and the left. Critics of the U.S. government and its imperial aims often allow an exception for the Second World War. To many, it is the good war, seemingly exempt from the same type of analysis and criticism heaped on other wars. But I think, as Marxists, we need to look a bit closer at this war to figure out exactly what was going on, what it meant, and to see if we can draw some lessons from today from this really epic conflict. So I'm not going to do a play-by-play of what happened during the war and the events. I think that's going to, would of course, take too long. I just want to make some key arguments on what the war was all about, and I'm going to leave out a lot, which I hope we're going to get to in the discussion, and to try to draw some lessons for today. So I'd like to begin, which is a good place to begin, with Trotsky. People may remember the Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky was assassinated by a Stalinist spy in 1940, less than a year into the war, and before the U.S. was involved. But I think he had some insight into the conflict that was just developing. He wrote, "The present war, the Second Imperialist War, is not an accident. It does not result from the will of this or that dictator. It was predicted long ago. It derived its origin inexorably from the contradiction of international capitalist interests." And he warned, "Should the working class tie up its fate in the present war with the fate of imperialist democracy, it would only ensure itself a new series of defeats. The task of the revolutionary proletariat does not consist of helping the imperialist armies create a revolutionary situation, but of preparing, fusing, and tempering its international ranks for revolutionary situations of which there will be no lack." So Trotsky saw World War II as an imperialist war, and one which would create revolutionary situations, much as the First World War did. Trotsky was probably talking about revolutionary situations in the imperialist countries, which did not take place during World War II for a variety of reasons, but there's an additional revolutionary potential that Trotsky could not have foreseen. For millions of people around the world, the world war could not merely be boiled down to the struggle of one imperialism versus another. They had to struggle against military occupation by Germany and Japan, and some in the ghettos and concentration camps had to struggle for their very existence. So the war in reality had a dual nature. And I like the formulation of Donnie Gluckstein. This is his book, People's History of the Second World War, Resistance versus Empire, which I highly recommend. And I think we have that in Haymarket. He boils it down to an imperialist war and a people's war, which he uses to describe the two very different types of conflict that were taking place. On the one hand, a war led by elites to preserve or expand their military, political, and economic power. On the other hand, a war fought by ordinary people not only to defend what's theirs, but to build a different, more just, and equal world. So let's go through them in turn. In what way was World War II a war for empire and not a war for democracy, humanitarianism, and the four freedoms, as many history books claim? First of all, if you look at how the war was conducted and why decisions were made, it was clear that on the Allied side, as well as on the Axis, one of the main objects was preserving colonial rule and expanding imperial influence. Britain's main goal in the war, once the immediate threat of German invasion had passed, was protecting its colonies. People may know that the Soviets suffered the overwhelming brunt of the German war machine, losing up to 20 million soldiers and civilians. Stalin continually pressured his allies, the British and the Americans, to open up a new front by invading France, but the Western allies refused for more than 2 years, in large part because of the insistence of British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Churchill was more interested in protecting British colonies in Egypt and Palestine, which guarded the route to British India. Churchill advocated the Mediterranean strategy, whereby the Allies would slog across North Africa and then invade Italy. Of course, this allowed Hitler to commit the bulk of its troops to the Eastern Front with Russia and probably prolong the war, but these were not Churchill's priorities. Similarly, the Axis powers, Germany, Japan, and Italy, were interested in colonies, not in protecting theirs so much as creating new ones, which was crucial in a world with restrictive trade policies. Italy and Japan came late to the colonial game and needed sources of raw material to compete as an industrial giant. Germany had their colonies stripped from them after World War I, and Hitler won support from the German military and economic leaders by promising to return the empire to its former glory. The Axis conquests were incredibly brutal and oppressive, yet it was hypocritical for the Allies to condemn the Italian invasion of Ethiopia when they had already invaded and divided up the rest of Africa. It was also hypocritical for them to condemn Japan's conquests in the Pacific, when every one of their conquests, except for China, from Vietnam to Malaysia to the Philippines, had been colonies of European powers or the U.S. And even with China, large parts of the country had been economically dominated by the European powers before the Japanese invasion. And I'd argue the Soviet Union was also an imperial power competing over the spoils. For some reason, defenders of Stalin seemed to ignore the Nazi-Soviet pact, in which the Soviet Union used the opportunity of the German invasion of Poland to create colonial buffers by taking over eastern Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Finland. After the war, the Soviet Union kept most of eastern Poland and shifted Poland to the west with an accompanying mass population transfer. As the United States, despite its control of colonies such as the Philippines and Puerto Rico, it long ago decided it didn't really need colonies in order to dominate. It could rule economically through bribery and economic coercion, along with the occasional military intervention, which had already demonstrated in Latin America. So on the eve of World War II, it wasn't looking for new colonies, it wanted access, tariff-free economic access to markets and raw materials. In 1940, as Britain stood alone against the Nazis, the U.S. offered military assistance in the form of the Lend-Lease Act, but only after Britain promised to open up its colonies to U.S. trade and investment, and to open up Chinese trade, long a key U.S. demand for the open door after the war. Trotsky summed up the U.S. position like this. U.S. capitalism is up against the same problems that pushed Germany in 1914 on the path of war. The world is divided, it must be redivided. For Germany, it was a question of organizing Europe. The United States must organize the world. Hitler's history is bringing humanity face to face with a volcanic eruption of American imperialism, which indeed it was. So the key allies, US, Britain, and the Soviet Union, were fighting to divide the world up among themselves in the same way that the Axis were. Nothing sums up the blatant nature of these goals more than an account that Churchill gave of his discussion with Stalin at Yalta in 1945. And I'll spare you my Winston Churchill accent. but this is Churchill's account. The moment was apt for business, so I said, let us settle our affairs in the Balkans. Your armies are in Romania and Bulgaria. We have interests, missions, and agents there. Don't let us get at cross purposes in small ways. So far as Britain is concerned, how would it do for you to have 90% predominance in Romania, for us to have 90% of the say in Greece, and go 50-50 about Yugoslavia? While this was being translated, I wrote on a half sheet of paper, Romania, Russia 90%, the others 10%. Greece, Great Britain 90%, Russia 10%. Yugoslavia, 50-50. Hungary, 50-50. Bulgaria, Russia 75%, the others 25%. I pushed this across to Stalin. Thanks. Who had by then heard the translation. There was a slight pause. Then he took the pencil and made a large tick upon it and passed it back to us. It was all settled in no more time than it takes to set down. After this was a long silence. The penciled paper lay on the center of the table. At length I said, might it not be thought rather cynical if it seemed we had disposed of these issues, so fateful to millions of people, in such an offhand manner? Let us burn the paper. No, you keep it, said Stalin. This bartering of nations as if they're pawns on a chessboard may be shocking, but it should not surprise us as Marxists. After all, this is the nature of capitalism. The state serves the interests of capital. Capital needs empire, that is, access to raw markets and raw material, control over prices and production. They need that in order to survive. This can be seen further if we look at the conduct of U.S. corporations during the war. While it's known they made immense profits in the United States, they also made immense profits from the Nazis. General Motors, Ford, RCA, ITT, Coca-Cola, IBM, probably many others, all had affiliates in Germany, which continued to function under the Nazis and continued to communicate and take direction from corporate offices in the U.S. during the war. And these companies were crucial to Nazi war aims. GM and Ford produced trucks for the Nazi war effort. And at one point, over half the trucks of the German war machine were produced by these two American companies. ITT created the communication network, which was to make the Blitzkrieg attacks possible. Standard Oil continued to ship fuel to the Germans through Switzerland. And since they had trouble buying oil from overseas, provided the Germans the method to produce oil from coal. Most outrageous, IBM built a punch card system in the Third Reich that would allow the Nazis to keep track of concentration camp prisoners. Where they were, who they were, Jews, gypsies, communists, and their assignment, work camp, gas chamber, so on and so forth. This is why the tattoos were necessary. The system was maintained by IBM employees at the German affiliate who went to the concentration camps to maintain the machines, and they kept in contact with the New York office. And of course, for IBM, as well as the other American corporations, all the profits from this blood money were remitted to the American headquarters after the war. So it's clear that states fought this war for empire. The corporation's goal was simply to make a profit. But despite this, so was this a war pitting fascism against democracy? United States at the time could hardly be called a paragon of democracy or freedom. It was a country built on genocide and racism, in which white supremacy and Jim Crow still flourished. In fact, the anti-Jewish Nuremberg laws that the Nazis developed were explicitly modeled on Jim Crow legislation, and the segregation, denigration, and exclusion of the inferior race, blacks in the United States, Jews in Nazi Germany. And I think it's telling that Hitler described his plan for the depopulation of the USSR as analogous to the US treatment of Indians. Hitler says, there was only one duty, to Germanize the country by the immigration of Germans and to look upon the natives as redskins. It's not to mention the infamous theft of the property of Japanese Americans and their confinement to concentration camps for the duration of the war, which was accompanied by vicious anti-Japanese racism during the war in films, propaganda posters, which caricatured and dehumanized the Japs as this savage, evil race. In fact, before the war, there was a lot of sympathy among ruling elites in both Britain and the U.S. for the Nazis. To many in the ruling class, the real threat was communism. And Hitler, whatever his unsavory methods, was first and foremost about the crushing of Bolshevism at home and abroad. In reality, it would have been termed appeasement when Britain and France allowed Hitler to occupy part of Czechoslovakia was not really because of cowardice, as it's usually depicted, but due to real sympathy with Hitler and his goals by people like Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. Neville Henderson, the British ambassador to Germany, described Nazi Germany as the great social experiment. And the Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, praised the Nazis as genuine haters of communism. Actually, even after Hitler's invasion of Poland, Halifax and other Hitler appeasers continued to try to find a modus vivendi and avoid war while allowing Hitler to keep his conquests. And people may know prominent Americans such as Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, Joseph Kennedy, the father of John Kennedy, who was the ambassador to Britain, were all fans of Adolf Hitler, as was the former King of England, Edward VIII. So actually, as historian Jock Powles, which he has another book here,
The Good War,
which is also really good, focuses much more on the United States. As he argues, the American power elite liked fascism not only because it proved to be good for business. Another equally important reason was that fascism was far less distasteful to the American establishment than Bolshevism. In the eyes of the corporate leaders of the United States, communism posed a far greater danger than fascism. Moreover, fascism seemed to provide an effective solution of the so-called red peril by smashing unions, smashing left-wing organizations, and restoring profitability. Harry Truman, when he was still a senator, had told the press something I think that was fairly telling of the ruling class attitude. He says, if we see that Germany is winning, we ought to help Russia. And if Russia is winning, we ought to help Germany. And that way, let them kill as many as possible. So this was not a war for democracy. It was a war for empire. And it was not based on humanitarian principles. And the clearest example of this is the American attitude to the Holocaust. The U.S. government was well aware of the plan to massacre the Jews, well, both from its own intelligence reports and from various articles that appeared in the New York Times. Yet Congress and the Roosevelt administration refused to allow in more than a trickle of Jews in the lead-up to the Holocaust. And people may know the U.S. Government famously turned away the refugee ship, the St. Louis, with 936 Jewish men, women, and children aboard when it tried to dock in 1939. The ship had to return to Europe, and many of its passengers were killed in the concentration camps. And as the genocide took place, the U.S. took no action to stop it. It could have bombed the railways to the death camps or the crematoria. In fact, many Allied bombers flew over these locations to hit nearby targets, but it wasn't a strategic priority for the Allied military. These priorities had more to do with targeting German and Japanese civilians. The myth was that the U.S. and Britain were only hitting economic and military targets that would affect the Axis' ability to fight. But in fact, even if these were the targets, the bombing at the time was too inaccurate to be able to confine attacks to just a few buildings. But the bombings were directed at whole population centers, not just industry. This became even more clear toward the end of the war as the Allies started using incendiary bombs, which would light a whole city on fire, firebombing in Dresden, which had virtually no strategic value. Over 100,000 civilians were killed in this way in February of 45. Another 100,000 were killed during the firebombing of Tokyo the next month. And this is even before we get to the biggest Allied atrocity of the war, the dropping of the nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which killed nearly 200,000 people. The official account given was that this was necessary to avoid a bloody invasion of the Japanese mainland. But in fact, as many historians have pointed out, and even General Eisenhower admitted at the time, by the summer of 1945, Japan was ready to surrender, and no invasion would have been necessary. But the real reason why the bombs were dropped had more to do with the looming Cold War, with the Soviet Union. The Soviets had just entered the war and had started to invade China and Korea. The bombing allowed the U.S. to be the sole occupying power in Japan, and it sent a message to the Soviets who the real superpower was. Much of the same purpose was involved in the firebombing of Dresden, which happened just as Soviet armies were approaching the city, right? This is what we can do. Watch out. Don't mess with us. These intentional bombings of civilians led to millions of deaths, but probably accomplished very little in terms of war aims. The stated intention was to terrorize and demoralize the enemy, but from all accounts of the bombings, all the bombings did was to inculcate a greater hatred of the Allies among the civilian population. In much the same way, U.S. drone attacks today across the Middle East and South Asia create new recruits for the Taliban and ISIS. But the strategy of civilian bombing had its own military logic. The Allies were fairly evenly matched in ground forces, but they dominated in the air, so they struck at the enemy the easiest way possible, at their civilian population. Understanding the brutal imperial nature of the conflict would have been crucial to the left and the working class at home in the United States. After a decade of militancy during the 1930s, the offensive of the working class, good, I can see the time right there, so. The offensive of the working class could have gone much further during the 40s, but was held back due to the war. The gains of the 30s were limited, I think, in large part because of the severe economic crisis of the Great Depression. Now with full employment, workers held much more bargaining power, but AFL and the CIO signed a no-strike pledge during the course of the war, and the Communist Party, running under the slogan "Communism is 20th century Americanism," refused to take an independent line, supported the no-strike pledge, and tried to actively enforce it among its recalcitrant workers. Speed ups and long hours with insufficient pay did lead to a major strike wave during the war. There were actually 14,000 strikes during the war, with 7 million workers participating, which was actually the largest strike wave in history up to that point. And it actually did win some material gains. The average weekly wage went from $23 to $44 during the war. But a lot of these strikes were wildcat strikes, which means, you know, without the permission of the union and not as organized. And because of the hostility of the unions and the communists to strike action, the strike movement was a lot weaker and a lot less organized. This began the process of conservatizing of the American labor movement. Understanding the role of the government as a representative of the capitalist class, and thus the imperial nature of the war, would have gone a long way to sustaining a left-wing approach to unionization in the U.S. Wow. As Trotsky wrote, the victory of the imperialists of Great Britain and France would be not less frightful for the ultimate fate of mankind than that of Hitler and Mussolini. The task posed by history is not to support one part of the imperialist system against another, but to make an end of the system as a whole. Now, the other aspect of the war, the resistance, the people's war, as Gluckstein called it, and I'm going to skip some of the part about why I call it a people's war. I think basically is we can't call it a proletarian war because these resistance were not simply just workers and intentionally tried to make cross-class alliances, but they did look to something different. They did look to, they did mobilize working people. They did criticize, you know, the powers that be and not just think that they're going to replace the Nazis with what we had before the war. So I think people's war is as good a label as any. Resistance came in many forms, the spreading of propaganda, sabotage, attacks on occupation soldiers, assassinations, and in some rare places they were able to accomplish mass strikes. I got to skip some parts about the resistance, but I think if you watch, I don't know if anybody here watches science fiction, but TV shows like Colony or Man in the High Castle tend to like look at the resistance as they're corrupt and they're, you know, super violent, and maybe the best thing would be to be an independent intellectual and be apart from all of it. But I think that neglects what happened during the World War II and the real resistance. And the bravery that these people showed, even nonviolent resistance could lead to a death sentence. If people know about the White Rose conspiracy in Germany, who were putting up flyers and of course were rounded up and executed. You could be imprisoned, tortured, sent to concentration camps. Milo Manjilas, who was a prominent Yugoslav communist, recounts that upon the liberation of Belgrade in October 1944, he did not encounter one, literally not one, member of the party. There were thousands of sympathizers, even wildcat non-party groups, but the party members had been wiped out in camps, in gas extermination trucks, and on execution grounds. At the execution ground in Yayanitsi, night after night, every night in the course of 3.5 years, hundreds of hostages and patriots, mostly communists and their sympathizers, were executed. In France, 60,000 Communist Party members were killed during the war. And the Nazis at least made sure that any resistance was met by massive retaliation, not just upon the resistors, but upon the population at large. In Yugoslavia, after the resistance killed 20 German soldiers in 1941, the Nazis massacred more than 5,000 villagers. In Czechoslovakia, after The Nazi leader Reinhard Heydrich, one of the architects of the Final Solution, was assassinated. Two villages were razed to the ground and 13,000 people arrested. All the men above 16 were executed, and the women and children were sent to concentration camps, where many of them died. An incredible burden was placed on these resistors: continue to fight and risk massive retaliation, or give it up and wait passively for liberation. And this is not to mention, and I don't really have time to go into the resistance during the Holocaust, which is incredibly brave during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, even in the concentration camps. There was something on, I think it was on the History Channel or something, about the Sobibor rebellion, where they're half starving to death, but they're able to massacre several of their guards and escape. Most of them were killed during the escape, but some of them were able to make it. The strongest force in these uprisings and the resistance were the partisans, which were usually a cross-class, cross-political bodies, but usually led by the Communist Party. Because they were led by the left, their agenda was not just getting rid of the Nazis or the Japanese, but a new and better kind of society. A Canadian major described his visit to the Yugoslav partisans. It was the unity of the community, symbolized in the local committee, that was the strength of the Freedom Front movement in Yugoslavia. It was democracy at its best. People in any free community were absolutely free to do as they wished. A Greek woman who had fought with the partisans described the connection between the partisan struggle and women's liberation. An incredibly sexist society where honor killings were not uncommon, she writes, "Before the war, I couldn't go anywhere without my parents knowing where I was going, whom I was going with, when I would be back. I never went anywhere alone. That is until the occupation came and I joined the resistance. In the meantime, because we were right in the midst of the enemy, we had an underground press there at the house. It was very dangerous, but my parents had to support us. The minute you confront the same danger as a boy, the minute you also write slogans on the walls, the minute you also distributed leaflets, the minute you also attended protest demonstrations along with the boys, and some of you were also getting killed by the tanks, they could no longer say to you, 'You're a woman, so sit inside while I go to the cinema.' You gained your equality when you showed what you can endure in terms of the difficulties, the dangers, the sacrifices, and all as bravely and with the same degree of cunning as a man. These old ideas fell aside. That is, the resistance always tried to put the woman next to the man instead of behind him. Women fought a double liberation struggle." Many of these partisan groups set up their own governments in the territories they controlled. In Greece, they were able to have an election in which 1 million people voted under Nazi occupation. And there were some reforms. In addition for rights for women mentioned above, communist-led rebels in China, Vietnam, other places put land reform on the agenda by confiscating land from landlords who were collaborators. But they didn't confiscate land from everybody, but they put it on the agenda and put landlords on notice. So in part because of the cautious stance of the Communist Party, workers' revolution was not planned or organized for, but because of the massive repression, also mass action by workers was difficult, but not impossible. In May of 1941, the Communist Party of France led a strike of 100,000 French miners, and in March of 1941, 200,000 marched in Athens in protest against conscripted labor. The Nazis violently suppressed it, but much fewer conscripted labor they were able to get much fewer conscripted labor from Greece than any place else because of this resistance. So that's the left-wing resistance. But what complicates the situation is there was often a role of conservatives who also put themselves forward as the resistance. Of course, you had in many countries just indigenous fascists that cooperated with the Nazis. This was true, of course, in Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria, which set up fascist governments and didn't even need to be invaded to ally themselves with Nazi Germany. In France, a Vichy government was set up, which actually helped the Nazis a lot in repressing dissent and sending Jews to concentration camps. Other right-wingers did engage in resistance. However, their record's much less heroic than the partisans. Many conservative nationalists engaged in what was called attentism. In other words, they could organize in secret, wait for liberation, and conserve your forces. And they were openly opposed to what they saw as the dangerous, aggressive policy of the partisans. Despite this, that the partisans were the ones really fighting, the allies, U.S. and Britain, were much more likely to support these conservatives than the left-wing partisans. Britain and the U.S. put forward General Charles de Gaulle, a right-winger with absolutely no political or military experience, as the leader of the resistance. The allies also, and particularly Britain, had a strategy of appealing to French colonial officials, especially in North Africa, to ally with them against the Germans. Colonial officials mostly ignored these efforts and cooperated with the fascist Vichy regime. In fact, throughout occupied Europe, Britain and the U.S. showed much less interest in fighting fascism and quite a bit of concern with the influence of Bolshevism. Poland, they supported the remnants of a former fascist government. In Greece, they came in and with a fascist prime minister that had turned against the Germans, put him in power, the king who had supported the fascists, putting him back in power and insisting that the whole resistance recognize that as the legitimate government. In fact, Britain and the U.S. supported conservative and pro-fascist elements even when they were completely ineffective in fighting the occupiers. In Yugoslavia, they supported the Chetniks, who were much more interested in fighting the partisans than they were interested in fighting the Nazis. And of course, in China, they supported the nationalist Chiang Kai-shek, who spent much more of his energy fighting the communists and very little of his energy fighting the Japanese. Only towards the end of the war, when it became evident that like they weren't going to get anything out of these nationalist right-wingers, did they start supporting groups like the Yugoslav partisans or the or Mao. Okay, I'm going to have to skip another Trotsky quote. So this dynamic gets even more complicated when you look at the role of colonialism in the resistance. In Burma and Indonesia, the nationalist movements didn't see a big difference between the... In fact, Japan promised them independence. So initially, these nationalist movements were cooperating with the Japanese occupation, which, of course, this independence was kind of a joke. But... In Poland and the Baltic states, you really didn't have a communist resistance because the Soviet Union was the one that had just been occupying them. Now it's the Nazis, so that becomes incredibly complicated. And the Allies, despite their commitment to freedom, always resolved to restore the pre-war colonies once the war ended. They issued, I think, just as the Japanese surrendered in the Pacific, the U.S. issued General Order Number 1, which was, you must surrender to the Allied powers, not to the nationalist movements that you're seeing that are defeating you. And this is true in Vietnam, where they had to be actually forced to accept French rule once again. And all these places were recolonized. The other thing complicating the nature of the resistance was the treacherous role the Soviet Union played in directing the communist parties and in repressing struggle. Stalin's main interest, of course, was not in promoting world revolution, but in preserving and enhancing the power of the Soviet Union as an imperial state. As such, he had an interest in keeping Britain and France happy and these other colonial powers and making sure they made good on They made good on the areas he wanted influence from the war. And like the talk that he had, that Stalin had with Churchill at Yalta. So the communists everywhere undertook cross-class alliances and underplayed any goals of proletarian revolution. They even reached out to reactionary or even former fascist forces, and this was a conscious policy. And communist parties were instructed to follow the dictates of the U.S. and British armies and at times surrender their arms to them as the war was ending. This happened in Greece, where the communists were told to basically give up the fight against the reactionary king and the fascist prime minister. In Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh ordered all resistance fighters to cooperate with the British who were occupying to make room for the French. Combination of rearmed Japanese soldiers, this happened throughout the Pacific. They let the Japanese keep their guns so that they could put down the nationalist resistance. But in Vietnam, combination of rearmed Japanese soldiers and the communist militias themselves put down the anti-colonial rebellion. A lot of it was led by Trotskyists, and they were executed. I think the role of after the war, seeing the role of the Soviet Union, I think is pretty clear. Eastern Europe was basically used as more colonies for, even though they were independent countries, for the Soviet Union, and they brutally suppressed throughout the Cold War, they brutally suppressed any attempt to be independent, like the 1956 rebellion in Hungary. Let me talk about, I think you still have time, yeah. Let's talk about Italy. So Italy, I think, is a good case study of how right-wingers, allied powers, and the communists, and working-class rebellion all worked together to form this, what happened during the resistance. March 1943, 100,000 workers shut down factories throughout northern Italy. And Mussolini was shocked at the rejection of fascism and forced to offer concessions. This weakness, combined with the Allied invasion of Sicily a few months later, caused the fascist Grand Council to overthrow Mussolini and sue for peace with the Allies. Nothing had changed in the fascist system except that the person of the dictator was removed, yet the Allies did not hesitate to immediately recognize the new fascist prime minister and the pro-fascist king as the legitimate government of Italy. This caused Hitler to invade Italy. The new prime minister, Marshal Pietro Badoglio, was more afraid of the communists who would gain power from a united resistance, so he refused to mobilize against the German invasion. The Nazis brought back Mussolini under a puppet regime in the north, with the Allied recognized fascist government reigning in the south. This did not stop people from taking the streets to remove fascist symbols, free prisoners, and take over newspaper offices to allow an anti-fascist press to appear. And now the working class again had a massive work stoppage in the north, demanding a double of rations, an end to curfews, an end to layoffs, and exclusion of Nazis from the workplace. The SS began rounding up the leaders, so the strikers simply added a new demand, freedom for those arrested. The strikers declared, "On to complete victory. Your threats do not frighten us. Just give us what we demand and we will return to work." The Nazis offered pay increases of between 40 and 50%, which were rejected. The workers refused to negotiate with any Germans. After a week, they did return to work, but they stressed they were returning to work voluntarily and not because of repression. Then this working class rebellion fed the insurrection. By June 1944, there were two to 300,000 armed partisans creating havoc for the German occupiers. They launched 5,449 surprise actions, 218 pitched battles, 458 locomotives destroyed, 356 bridges blown up, 5,573 operations to sabotage power lines and communications, and tens of thousands of German troops killed. This led to massive reprisals, which forced them to switch tactics. Instead of primarily targeting troops, they targeted the police and the collaborators who made war against them. When the fascist police began an anti-guerrilla operation in the area, the partisans killed 17 of them. As a result, 100 of the remaining 150 police deserted their posts, and some even joined the partisans. Kesselring, the German general in charge of Italy, said that to him, the battle against the partisans was of equal importance to the battle against the Allied troops, though the latter outnumbered and way outgunned the former. And the partisans saw themselves as a different kind of fighter. An agreement between various Italian partisans groups in August 1944 renounced the hierarchy of the traditional military and declared, "The war against Nazi fascists is only the preliminary step on the road towards our ultimate objective, the radical reconstruction of the political, moral, and social life of our country. We are fighting for democracy, freedom in the fullest sense of the word, justice, and the dignity and respect that are due to man." As the partisans liberated areas, they put these ideals into practice, forming their own local governments, purged of fascists with direct democracy. But the Allies and conservatives in Italy condemned these attempts at democracy. They called for the partisans to cease all activity and wait for the Allied troops. When the fascist prime minister Badoglio was finally ousted by the Italians, Churchill's foreign minister was enraged. "A nation which has unconditionally surrendered has no right to present the Allies with a government chosen by themselves." In order to convince the Allies of their sincere opposition to the Nazi occupation, a final strike wave occurred in the spring of 1944, this time encompassing more than 500,000 workers. But despite the bravery and idealism, the rank and file of the Italian Communist Party, its leadership was tied to Stalin and to the notion of the division of influence worked out at Yalta. The Italian Communist leader Togliatti, who had returned from Russian exile after the Allied invasion in March of 1944, joined the cabinet of the fascist Badoglio. Immediately, the line of the CP shifted. with its newspaper demanding that every legitimate reform, if it is not urgent, take second place, to be set aside, to be delayed until after victory. Its leadership insisted partisans must unite with industrialists, intellectuals, priests, ex-fascists. No one is excluded. Banning the clenched fist and the hammer and sickle. They banned the clenched fist and the hammer and sickle. As the North was finally liberated in April 1945, the partisans launched a general strike and all-out rebellion. Many towns, such as General, were liberated by the partisans before the Allied troops ever set foot in the city. And there was a kind of comical scene where the Allied troops entered Genoa after it had already been liberated, where the general says to his interpreter, "Tell them that my troops have liberated the city and that they are free men." And the translator refused to translate because he's like, he knew the truth. And then all of a sudden there's a roar, there's a crowd, and there's this line of thousands and thousands of captured German soldiers, all of them disarmed, and the partisans coming next to them. And the American general's like, all right. but immediately afterwards, the translator got a new message from the British brigadier. "Tell them, will you please, that this committee is dissolved as of tomorrow. All their functions cease. All their responsibilities are assumed by the Allied command." This process was repeated in other cities as partisans were disarmed and local committees dissolved. The Allied troops didn't have the ability to carry this order out their own. It was only by the cooperation of the CP, still the largest and most prestigious group on the left, that allowed the obliteration of the revolution that was occurring and a return to capitalist normalcy. And I'll skip that part. Okay, let's talk about lessons. What kind of lessons can we learn from today about the experience of the Second World War? Number one, the wars of the imperial powers are always bosses' wars. They will always seek to couch their goals in humanitarian or democratic language, but their goals are always military, political, and economic dominance. This means the left needs to develop a knee-jerk anti-imperialism, ready to impose and organize against any foreign war, no matter how noble the rhetoric or how repellent the enemy seems to be. Number two, we need to express solidarity with those who resist imperialism in all its forms. This would include opponents of U.S. imperialism, but also any other imperialisms. Just as the victims of Nazi and Japanese occupation were right to resist, so are the victims of Russian, Chinese, or even Saudi imperialism. A workers' revolutionary movement must be independent from its class enemies and independent from imperialism. It's incumbent for workers' movement to work with other forces, of course, for common goals. And it's hard to fault desperate resistors from taking aid from whatever source they can. I'm thinking not only of partisans who sought British or American aid, but Syrian revolutionaries who are pleading for aid from the West. But in order to advance their own interests, and particularly in order to prepare the way for a proletarian revolution, workers need to be independent. Because despite some common interests, all other class forces, middle class or bourgeois, will seek to deflect or squash attempts at revolution and a radical reconstruction of society. And the last lesson is the forces of the left need to work towards what Marx and Trotsky called permanent revolution. It is in wars and other crises that we see the weakness of the capitalist system. The ruling class wants to exploit these crises and repress us even further, as we know Naomi Klein has pointed out. But we need to exploit them ourselves to push for a workers' revolution. In fact, such a revolution is unthinkable without wars and economic crisis weakening the capitalist ideological and material hold on the working class. As to how we look at the legacy of the World War II, I'll leave the last word to Howard Zinn. People may know historian Howard Zinn was a veteran of World War II, but was also harshly critical of the war and of U.S. role in it. He described the short-term effects of the war, obviously defeating fascism, and the critical and contradictory long-term factors. This is what he says. "We can argue endlessly over whether there was an alternative in the short one, whether fascism could have been resisted without 50 million dead. But the long-term effect of World War II on the thinking of the world was pernicious and deep. It made war, so thoroughly discredited by the endless slaughter of World War I, noble once again. It enabled political leaders, whatever miserable adventure they would take us into, whatever mayhem they would wreak on another people, 2 million dead in Korea, at least as many in Southeast Asia, hundreds of thousands in Iraq, to invoke World War II as a model." And I think there's a real danger of ignoring this imperial nature of World War II and the struggle from below, which presented an alternative to the capitalist cruelty and chaos which led to the war in the first place.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.